Thank you for joining us today for the second episode of the Whitaker Report, a discussion with thought leaders about the future of economic development. My name is Dean Whitaker, President and CEO of Whitaker Associates, a data analytic company serving the needs of economic development and commercial real estate organizations. I will be your host as we endeavor to see around the corner to see what's next. Today, we will be speaking with Bree Langamo, JD, Director of Entrepreneurship and Assistant Professor of Law and Entrepreneurship at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. Bree leads the entrepreneurship engagement across the campus and the community and provides thought leadership on the entrepreneurship mindset through speaking and training. In her former role as president of the Entrepreneurship Learning Initiative, Bree worked with academic, government, economic development, and corporate organizations around the world to empower their constituents with an entrepreneurial mindset. In addition to the number of publications on the topic of entrepreneurial mindset, Bree has conducted training and speaking engagements across the United States, Puerto Rico, Mexico, Canada, and South Africa. Please join me as we welcome Bree Langamo to our Whitaker Report.
To be with you today.
Thank you for joining us. We're looking forward to learning more about what an entrepreneurial mindset is and why it's going to be needed in this new world of work where we're headed. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, great question. You know, to start out, the word entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial are both hard to say.
Yes, and for sure.
Right? So they're not user-friendly words. But I think that's partially to do also with kind of our understanding around what entrepreneurship is. And so, you know, when we traditionally think of entrepreneurs, of course, we think of you know, someone who starts a business. You know, sometimes we think kind of negatively about them as the greedy salesman, or, you know, those who are kind of, you know, won the lottery, you know, like the Mark Zuckerbergs, or, you know, so we have all these kind of traditional notions around what entrepreneurship is, but there's actually a lot we can learn from entrepreneurs and the way that they think and act, or the mindset that they have. Because there's a lot of opportunity discovery skills in there, opportunity recognition, problem finding, problem solving, understanding that we need to create value, whatever it is we do, whether we end up selling something like an entrepreneur does, or we're within an established organization looking to continue to be innovative. And so to me, I'm really have been fascinated with the concept around producing entrepreneurials, and not just entrepreneurs. And, you know, we know that entrepreneurs are the engines that drive our economy. I think it was the Kauffman Foundation that reported that all net new jobs come from companies that are 5 years or younger. But the challenge is people don't often self-identify as entrepreneurs or wanting to start a business. So if we can kind of plant the seeds of entrepreneurial thinking amongst people, some of them do become entrepreneurs, but not everyone needs to become an entrepreneur to benefit from entrepreneurial education or training. But I would say all members of society need to figure out how to be entrepreneurial.
One of the thoughts that occurs to me is it's a little bit like thinking like an owner. You know, when you're an employee at a company, my daughter works for a company, and in my view of her and how she relates to her employer, she thinks like an owner would in terms of how she behaves in the workplace, in terms of coming up with new ideas and looking at how the money's being spent and raising her concern if she sees that there's something happening that isn't in the customer's best interest. And so I think she thinks more like an entrepreneur, although she is an employee. Do you think that's part of that entrepreneurial mindset?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when you look at a founder of a startup, that's their baby. They have so much ownership. They're so self-directed. They're fully engaged. They're enthusiastic about their work because they're compelled by the problems that they're trying to solve. When you look at your daughter, she's acting sort of like a founder or an owner, like it's her baby too. And so the more we can kind of infect employees with that entrepreneurial mindset, the more engagement we'll see in the workforce. And I'm sure you're familiar, your audience is familiar with Gallup statistics around employee engagement, which are pretty abysmal. You know, a lot of employees around the world are not engaged in their work. When we look at entrepreneurial people, they tend to be hyper engaged in their work, and they tend to flourish, and they feel like they're useful and they're making a meaningful contribution. And I would argue that everyone wants to feel that way in their work. We don't want to just show up and kind of stamp in, stamp out. You know, we want to know that we're contributing and creating value, and that our contribution matters.
One thing I noticed in her situation, and I wonder if this is typical of some others, they don't reward that mindset in her, at least in her company, and I don't think they quite understand the value of it. And so, what happens to that mindset? So she shows up with this mindset, and pretty soon she's beaten down to the point where she's just going to be showing up at 8 o'clock and going home at 5 and calling it good. What transpires in organizations that kill that mindset? What happens?
That is an excellent question. And, you know, Dr. George Land has this theory around transformation, or kind of any living system, any organizational system, it has three phases. And so he looks at, you know, when a baby is born, it kind of goes through the life cycle, or a relationship, the phases it goes to, and then, you know, what organizations kind of go through. And when they're starting up, they're in this search phase, or this kind of like phase of discovery, where they don't have a lot of resources. There's a lot of ambiguity. They're using all those kind of like creativity, problem solving, collaborating, being resourceful. But as they create value and kind of hit this first breakpoint, as Dr. Land calls it, they have evidence of value creation. And if they keep replicating that, they kind of move into this growth phase. And this sounds very academic, but I'm getting to an important point here. When we're in the growth phase, we are looking to replicate success. We want to keep repeating it. So we start to become more efficient, more productive, more, you know, we want to have those policies and procedures in place. And this is where a lot of existing organizations kind of fall into. Like, once they've found success, they do want to keep replicating it. And they start to lose a sense of those discovery skills or being entrepreneurial, because they're actually trying to replicate success. But when you lose those kind of discovery skills in the search process, and then you have someone come along like your daughter, who's very entrepreneurial and wants to keep making it better and better and better and has new ideas to contribute, they're kind of in this growth phase of like, no, this is how we do it. This is how we replicate the success we had. But Dr. Land also said, nothing fails like success. His next breakpoint is, and this is in his book, Grow or Die, you could become obsolete, like we've seen with Kodak and other types of companies that kind of clung to old ways of thinking. If you're willing to kind of go back to that search phase, well, then that leads into innovation, and you continue to pivot and get even better. And maybe you end up doing something as an organization that you didn't start out to do. That's often the case. But if you cling to old ways of thinking in that growth phase, like a lot of organizations kind of make the mistake of doing, you potentially lose talent, like your daughter, who says, well, I need to be in an entrepreneurial, you know, workplace, because I want my contributions to matter. And I want to keep, you know, finding ways to improve and innovate and, you know, contribute. I don't want to keep doing the same, you know, 8 to 5.
Do you see that happening in that particular generation, where they want more meaningful work? I sense that in the millennials that I work with, that they want their work to matter. Maybe we all do, but it feels stronger in them than I've seen in, you know, I always felt I was just lucky to have a job, you know, and they think that isn't enough, that it needs to be meaningful work that they're doing, and it makes a difference in the world.
Absolutely. We are definitely seeing that in the younger generations, even in kind of the independent contractor workforce. Much more percentage of younger people in that kind of independent contractor workforce. And so a lot of times they have the autonomy to kind of control, you know, when they work, how they work, where they work from. And, you know, they want to have that kind of autonomy over their work, as opposed to clocking in and clocking out, or even caring that much about necessarily the stability of work that I think older generations, you know, care more about. They're willing to to take some more risks. I know here at Concordia College, we are really encouraging students to just get in and work in that startup environment, because that is where you can really kind of feel that all hands on deck. You know, everybody kind of acts like the owner. They all care about the mission, and they can see how exciting that, you know, that kind of workplace can be. I would argue for established organizations, they should try to find ways to keep that startup, you know, kind of feel within the organization, so that your employees are excited and feel like you're always moving forward, making progress. And, you know, they're going to attract, I think, a younger talent population by doing so.
I went through a program called the New North Center for Design and Business, and they were teaching us about innovation. And we went through this whole process as a group of 30 people or so, and we were broken out into smaller groups. And over a year period of time, we were taught to be how innovative thinking and kind of a more of a process of innovation. Many of these people that I went through the program with went back to their organizations, and they were really charged up to take these new ideas they had, these innovative thoughts they've garnered, and they go back there, and then they hit the wall. And if you change the word from innovation to disruption, it's closer to how it felt when they went back. They were trying to disrupt things because they had new ideas for how to do things. And as you've just said, the whole idea is to replicate what we already have and that's worked for us in the past. And then they hit the wall. Many of them didn't stay at that organization. They weren't there a year later. They were not in the same organization that they were in when they started this entrepreneurship innovation program.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, often you do sometimes see entrepreneurial people who will stick it out for a while. Like they'll, you know, they're very good at finding different pathways. They don't take no for an answer. They just might try to find a different door to go through. And so they have this, like, you know, kind of stubborn persistence of moving an idea forward. They don't really, you know, get too discouraged sometimes when ideas are pushed back on, but it does depend on the culture of an organization. And if you just keep, no matter what pathway you go, you just keep getting a no, and it's not going to happen because of the culture of that organization, they'll leave. Mm-hmm. They're looking for those entrepreneurial environments. And when I talk about entrepreneurship, I often talk about it in terms of the entrepreneurial person, the entrepreneurial process, and then the situation, which does matter. So we can, you know, learn the entrepreneurial mindset and learn from entrepreneurs. There is the entrepreneurial process that we can use to, you know, learn how to engage in opportunity discovery. But the situation can either encourage or discourage entrepreneurial behavior. And so those people who are entrepreneurial are going to be looking for the best environments that allow them to be who they are, and so they can contribute in meaningful ways.
How do you see the pandemic having affected this entrepreneurial mindset? What changes have occurred, and how do you see it impacting that mindset?
Well, I started at Concordia last January, so I had a good 2 months of normalcy, you know, before the pandemic kicked in. Having been in academia for over 15 years, you know, you generally kind of expect that things will move more slowly. So I was looking for a higher education institution that was quite progressive. And I did find that at Concordia, and just really good philosophical alignment as far as what entrepreneurship meant to them and to me. But what was interesting is where I, even at a faster paced college, and I thought, you know, adoption would move fairly quickly, or I'd have a good amount of early adopters, I still thought it would take some time maybe to reach, you know, higher levels of the institution or whatnot, or different disciplines. Once the pandemic hit, some of the things I had been talking about connected very quickly with faculty and staff here, and people became very, you know, interested in what is an entrepreneurial mindset? How do I think that way? How do I be more entrepreneurial? Because the disruption obviously caused so much change.
Yeah, and an uncertainty as well. So that's interesting.
Yes. Yeah. And I think entrepreneurial people become more comfortable with, like, that level of uncertainty. They're used to being, you know, they're okay with the ambiguity, lack of resources that might come with pushing forward a new idea. The other thing that this is kind of just an interesting angle of entrepreneurship that that was a little unexpected to me is that, you know, one of the constructs behind the mindset is around resiliency. You know, how do entrepreneurs persist through setbacks and challenges when other people seem to kind of either get stuck or quit quickly? And, you know, that's something that I've spent some time learning from entrepreneurs. You know, what is it about them that allows them to persist? And so what it really is part of their mindset. There's an explanatory style, and this is Dr. Martin Seligman's work. We tend to explain adverse events to ourselves either in an optimistic or a pessimistic way. And kind of what a mindset is an underlying belief system. So we quickly form beliefs. And if we don't figure out how to kind of disrupt, if we tend to be pessimists, and actually Dr. Seligman is a self-proclaimed pessimist, so he has to work pretty hard at this. But optimism can be learned. And the value of that is that if we can disrupt the beliefs we form about adverse events or challenges that come up, and we can reinterpret them and kind of re-energize ourselves, then we're more likely to continue to persist through adversity. And I think that's become more important during the pandemic because there obviously has been a lot of mental health challenges, you know, and people who it's hard to feel optimistic sometimes when you're so isolated and doesn't feel like there's any normalcy around us. So I didn't anticipate entrepreneurial mindset kind of, you know, spilling over into this, you know, kind of the challenges we're seeing with mental health in the pandemic.
That's a very interesting outcome because I think it appears that the mental health issue may turn out to be the greater challenge as opposed to the virus itself. And I get a survey from our county health department about every month asking how my mental health is doing. I don't know why I've been singled out, but I thought it was interesting that I get an email, kind of a checklist of how you're doing this month, you know, and so.
Yeah, interesting. That's fascinating.
But I think they have a survey organization that's actually surveying residents within the county, just checking the mental health of the county. And I thought that's pretty forward thinking.
That's very forward thinking. And I agree that mental health could end up being a bigger challenge than anything. And so then the work that I've kind of done around mindset itself. So when we say entrepreneurial mindset, kind of at the core of that is a belief that it's my responsibility to figure out how to leverage my own interests, skills, and abilities to become useful to others. So that's kind of the, you know, how do you create value, whatever it is that you're doing. But the mindset part has all, you know, all these different constructs, you know, that allow entrepreneurs to be successful, even in some of the most adverse circumstances that are fascinating. And, you know, they also relate to what we're going through right now. With entrepreneurial people, we tend to see high levels of self-efficacy. They have a lot of agency. They're, you know, as opposed to popular belief, they tend to be more intrinsically motivated than extrinsically. They have a growth mindset. They're, you know, resilient. And so it turns out, I guess, for the work that I do, it's more timely than ever. And of course, people are discovering new ways of working, and some of that is going to stay with us post-pandemic. So people are kind of, they're finding ways to be entrepreneurial during a, you know, a challenging time.
So here's an idea for you. The book that I'm reading now is called The Biggest Bluff. It's by Maria Konnikova, and it's
I love her.
Do you? Anyway, it's fascinating because it's really her experience learning to play poker in Las Vegas, and what she's talking about. Back to what you just said, it's the locus of control. You know, am I the victim here, or am I, you know, I'm the victor, and how that plays out in the world poker tournament.
Yeah, she is fascinating. I just listened to a podcast of her being interviewed by Shane Parrish of Farnham Street, which is Farnham Street's excellent to follow because they talk a lot about mental models. But Maria's work with brain pickings is also fascinating. What she did there was so interesting because she didn't know really anything about poker. She managed to convince one of the best players in the world to mentor her. And she decided to figure out how to master a new skill set. And that's kind of the growth mindset of entrepreneurial people is they're, you know, they think they can basically learn anything they care to learn about or master new skill sets. And so, you know, her, that whole book and you know, her work there is quite fascinating and very, very entrepreneurial.
So what do you see happening in entrepreneurship over the next 3 to 5 years? Where are we headed, and what kind of evolution do you see entrepreneurship and the entrepreneurial mindset taking as we go forward into the future?
I think that we have hit the cusp of really starting to redefine what work is. And I hope it gets more broad and even beyond like just thinking about, you know, in terms of a job. The thing I love about entrepreneurial mindset as opposed to just entrepreneurship as a standalone is I think entrepreneurial mindset is more about human flourishing. I mean, we all want to do something of meaning. We want to live meaningful lives. You know, we want to figure out how to leverage the things we, our skills and the things we care about with meeting the needs of others. And so I think the future of entrepreneurship is that it broadens quite a bit beyond just thinking about it in terms of startup. We start thinking about it, you know, what in whatever environment we might be and how we can contribute and be entrepreneurial. I recently read a book called Human Work, and the author defines human work as a kind of the integration of earning, learning, and serving, and that they all kind of work together. And so we have to get kind of past this, you know, education's a one-time event that then leads into a job. But really, we have kind of these lifetimes, right, of, you know, of learning, but we should be integrating kind of the experiential component into the college experience. And then when they get out into the workforce, learning should be, you know, included there and upskilling. And we're going to need to keep adapting. I mean, I think the pace of technology and the changing job types are, it's moving so fast. We just can't prepare people for one career or, you know, one type of job. I think people need to really be prepared more to be adaptable and get more comfortable with change and uncertainty that is happening in all fields.
What's driving this rate of change in your view? What's propelling us? It feels like it's growing. Change is happening exponentially now, not linear. And the human species is trying to catch up.
Yeah. And Thomas Friedman wrote a book called Thank You for Being Late. And he talks about this, just the rate of technology is, you know, faster than we could have ever fathomed. And he also talks about it won't come down to kind of like the digital divide that people think. It'll be really a learning divide. It's going to come down to people who, it's going to be the learners versus the non-learners. If you're not willing to kind of learn and adapt and upskill, you'll languish in this environment because it's just changing so quickly. And I do think technology, artificial intelligence, obviously, you know, all that robots has a huge impact, but I find it to be way more optimistic than others kind of present it, you know, as, you know, 50% of jobs will be lost to, you know, AI, or I look at it more as we have better potential, you know, for reaching human potential. Do we really want to keep doing routine tasks? Or, you know, can we get to, you know, higher level thinking and, you know, bigger contributions? There's always going to be, you know, this kind of human component that only humans can contribute that'll never be replaced. And I think that's, you know, kind of the key to this advancement is how do we look at our contributions in a bit different way?
I understand. In terms of what's next, you said that, you know, we're going to become a broader definition of that. As we have more and more technology take over more and more of the traditional work, what does that free us up to do? What else could we be doing with our creativity and our time?
I'll reference back to the Human Work book too, because he talks about kind of four types of people once technology has really kind of taken place of, you know, routinized kind of work. And he talks about the helpers, the bridgers, the integrators, and the creators. And all of these kind of positions are, you know, uniquely human. And so I think, you know, work starts to, you know, look more different as far as like the helpers are going to be, you know, in the healthcare profession are going to be sort of the bedside manner, the, you know, the empathy, the listening, the kind of humanity side of it. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to, you know, just kind of rethink what a role might be or what kind of role we play in society, in defining it a little bit more broadly in that way, as opposed to just job types. You know, we've had this history of thinking about jobs types and skills gaps and, you know, all these very, you know, specific things that kind of tie to positions as well, but maybe it's a more of a way of being. The other thing I would say is, you know, there's some thinking out there on, and this is debated, but, you know, are we headed into this like leisure economy, or, you know, will there be a universal basic income? And, you know, that's been batted back and forth, but what if, you know, what if people, some people don't work? And, you know, what will that mean? We tie our identities to work. And I think this is an opportunity for us to think more broadly in terms of that earning, learning, and serving that I mentioned before. Like, maybe we contribute and are useful, but we're not always paid for our work. You know, I think there's a real identity tied to an actual job that we need to loosen up on a bit.
I would agree with that. I'm married to a poet, and so in that regard, I can appreciate her contribution, but also how we don't necessarily reward those. And you think back to the pandemic, one of the things we've learned is we have essential workers that are poorly paid. And so we're starting to rethink the people that take care of our children and rethink the people that service our food and how important they are to our well-being. So maybe our roles will start to shift, and maybe our regard for each other will benefit from this experience that we're currently having.
Yeah. And I also think sort of the, you know, the arts and culture are going to become more and more important. I was at a Chamber of Commerce Economic Outlook Forum. I think this was actually a year ago, and the speaker was from the United Arab Emirates. And he was talking about how they are really enhancing the availability of arts and culture and kind of preparation for, you know, people who may not be working in the future, and how do we get back to kind of, you know, finding the meaning in arts and the contribution to our lives. So I find all that to be very, very exciting. And I'm really liking this concept of human work and kind of the integration of earning, learning, and serving, because I think it broadens, you know, our roles in our life of, you know, we can be doing different things at different times, and it might be learning, it might be serving, and it might be earning too. So, you know, as of right now, we need to pay the bills and whatnot, but I think there could be, you know, I think there could be some shift in that in the future.
That's a very fascinating idea. Looping back around, because many of our listeners are in economic development roles in their communities, what can a community do? What are some of the things that, maybe some examples that you've seen where communities have reached out and maybe created a learning center, or they've done something to help address this issue of mindset and helping to promote it?
I think similar to what you're saying about your daughter, where she might hit a wall within an organization and then leave, I think communities need to understand that that could also be the case for their citizens. Entrepreneurial people are going to be attracted to entrepreneurial environments. And so when we look at kind of the entrepreneurial ecosystem, we can't just think of it in terms of the entrepreneurs. We have to kind of think of it in terms of everyone that contributes and feeds it in, you know, different and creative ways. And so it might be higher education, it might be city government, it might be the library system. I did some work in Colorado Springs, you know, working across the community to instill an entrepreneurial mindset. And the libraries were amazing partners, because if you think about where libraries are placed, it's kind of, they're spread out really nicely throughout cities oftentimes. They're great, you know, education and training centers. So they also reach the community in a very accessible way. But we worked with the SBDCs and the workforce centers and the universities and the city as well. One example I would give from my work with the Entrepreneurial Learning Initiative, and I would encourage your listeners to look up mindsetmemo.com, to see a great example of the city of Albuquerque and how they've embraced an entrepreneurial mindset. In 2014, the mayor at the time, who was very entrepreneurial, really set out to make Albuquerque the most entrepreneurial city in the world. And they worked with their K through 12 and university system and their downtown partnership to engage in entrepreneurial mindset training. But the city ultimately created a public service university. So talk about, you know, being innovative within city government. And ultimately kind of committed to all city employees going through entrepreneurial mindset training. But the initial kind of pilot was around 500 city employees. And, you know, kind of like you were saying with your daughter, feeling like the owner, you know, of the organization, that's exactly what the supervisor of the sanitation department said. They improved customer service significantly. They all started really caring about and understanding their clientele and, you know, really were given the opportunity to take ownership of their work and run it like their own business. And so huge outcomes there. And also encourage you to go to elimindset.com if you want to read kind of the case study around that government deployment.
That's fascinating. So that gives me hope that we can reinstill a entrepreneurial mindset to in places where it's been, where it's dissipated.
Absolutely. We can always learn an entrepreneurial mindset in a, I would say you don't ever just kind of, you know, learn it and then you're done. You learn enough to know how to keep practicing it and keep developing it.
That's fascinating. Well, Bree, thank you very much for your time. I'm grateful for your thought leadership and what you're doing in your environment and how you've impacted the people around you and your willingness to share your thoughts with us today. I wish you well in your endeavors in the future and look forward to following you on the various podcasts and other places where you publish your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dean. It's been all my pleasure today.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Whitaker Report, Seeing Around Corners, and a special thanks to Bree Langamo for her help in us better understand the entrepreneurship mindset and its role in the future of work. Again, I'm Dean Whitaker, your host. Please subscribe to the Whitaker Report podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.